This is Series Tea, where we find the greatest entrepreneurs and investors in the world and force them to have tea with us, live on air. I'm Imad Akhun, founder and CEO of Mercury, and today we're having tea with Semel Shah. Through his seed fund, Haystack, he's invested in 70-plus startups, including Instacart, DoorDash, Opendoor. He's also a venture partner at Lightspeed and a great writer. Semel, thanks for having tea with us.
Thanks for having me, Imad.
Yeah, how did you get into investing?
I was writing a lot online while I was working at startups. And a lot of people started sharing it. This is about 7-8 years ago. And it kind of snowballed into a thing. And I met a lot of VCs. And one thing led to another. And then they bankrolled my first little micro fund. And those first two funds just took off. And I really loved it. And, you know, I got very lucky and was able to turn it into a career. I mean, it's the only career I've really ever had.
I feel like for the newer generation of investors, you're one of the few kind of writers and bloggers left. Why don't you like switch over to like TweetStorms and like...
I'm glad you asked that actually, because, well, I didn't expect you to ask that, but I'm glad you did. I actually don't like TweetStorms. I feel like when someone is sharing them where it's real-time information, like Scott Gottlieb, who is the ex-FDA director, or somebody like that, where they're just going at it in real time and trying to share information, that feels like a good use of the airwaves, versus me doing a tweet storm feels like I'd be clogging the airwaves. And so to me, it feels like impolite to do that. And so I rather feel like collect my thoughts, put it in one place. People can link to it. Maybe people are lazy and they don't link to it, and that's okay. Email's another channel. And so the writing isn't necessarily intended to be distributed. It's intended for me to capture my own learning. And then, you know, if other people find use in that, then that's great. But the intention is not to win distribution. Really? I also feel like sometimes, no, I don't really care about that. I mean, there's a quote I love from Epicurus where he said, like, you and I are enough of an audience, right? That's all that really matters. And I truly believe that. I also think that, like, sometimes I'll open up Twitter and I'll see, like, you know, I'll just pick on a friend. Like, if Kassar was tweeting and if he was doing a tweet storm and he'll say, you know, 37 dash. And I'm like, I don't want to read 37 tweets. Like, it's just the atomic unit of it doesn't make sense. So I think, like, you know, when someone like Mark Andreessen would tweet storm about an idea, you know, that's real time news for us, or Scott Gottlieb, or, you know, maybe some athlete who is sharing breaking news, or some reporter in the NBA. But like, it just doesn't feel like what I'm doing rises to that level, and it feels impolite.
I feel like there's a lot of things that VCs do that, or seed funds do, that don't always make sense to entrepreneurs. And I think a lot of it's fueled by kind of their incentives. So just on a high level, can you talk about like what is portfolio construction? And like
the job of an entrepreneur is to create value, right, through entrepreneurship, and to build a product or service. The product of an investment firm, whether it's Haystack or Lightspeed or something in between, is actually investment decisions. That's the only product. And so basically how you make all those investment decisions becomes the thing that you build. And the actual building unit of these funds are actually portfolios. So if anyone asks me like, hey, what are you building? It's like you're building a portfolio. What are you doing in the portfolio? Next layer down is you're basically trying to allocate money in a diversified way to things that are hopefully uncorrelated. This is the whole Ray Dalio thing. So, you know, you may have a sector focused fund that's focused on autonomous vehicles or on Bitcoin or something like that. If you don't hit that properly as like a trend, it's really dangerous. So what you're doing is you're going across the internet, let's say, or across software, and you're trying to invest in some B2B applications, some infrastructure, some consumer. And there you have how your portfolios are constructed.
That's kind of interesting. So are funds trying to be uncorrelated? I kind of assume that like a fund is like, oh, this fund does autonomous vehicles. They're going to do 20 of those. Like, oh, you're saying actually like a fund tries to not have too many bets in each sector.
I think that like it's there are very few funds that I know of that have been very hyper-focused in terms of sector that have performed well. I mean, you could argue Ribbit in your sector, Ribbit Capital has been like a stellar performer. Yeah. I would argue that FinTech broadly, the market cap of fintech, and we can come back to this globally, I think will be larger than the market cap of all social networking. So fintech was actually the biggest boom and the largest market. But then when going back, when you build a portfolio and you're kind of saying, look, I want to have, you know, I want to have exposure to these things, then you're basically, you have certain funds that could offer portfolio construction based on sector specificity. Mm-hmm. You could have a portfolio construction that balances geography, although I don't think that makes as much sense anymore. You could have a portfolio construction based on a stage or maturity of business. You could say Benchmark, I know historically, has done 70% of their checks into Series A and the remaining in B and opportunistic. And so there's many ways to like build a portfolio construction. I can say in like Haystack 5, where we are now, we don't have any consumer plays. We have one prosumer investment called Parable, which is an app that people use for meetings and retrospectives, but it's not really a consumer app or consumer service. And so when consumer deals come in, I always remark and say, it would be nice to add this to the portfolio to balance it out. It hasn't happened yet in the half year that we've been investing out of this fund. So there are different ways people construct the portfolio based on what's in there. And then you think about sizing and percentage ownership. So like, how much do you own of a core company? What's the reserve strategy? Which companies are you going to bulk into? All of this, I mean, we could do literally it could be a semester long course at Stanford Business School to learn this stuff. For people who are interested, you know, feel free to contact me. I'm always happy to talk about it.
I guess without knowing all of that as an entrepreneur, like what are the bits of that do you think that are like relevant? Like it's, you know, is it things like, oh, if I look at a fund and they have like a 50 million size fund, then I should like have at least this much allocation before I bother talking to them. Like what are these kind of dynamics that like an entrepreneur needs to care about?
There's a lot we could talk about it, but I would say for this podcast, there's two things I would encourage entrepreneurs to just take as reality. So number one is, it's very common someone will say, oh, Imad, I would, you know, let's say you're running a fund and you have all these like consumer home services startups in there that have been recognized. And then someone comes to you with that. You may not want to invest in the next one because you already got the exposure in those. And so there's this like actually cognitive gap where the entrepreneur thinks, oh my God, let me go talk to Joe because Joe has invested in these companies and my company is like that. What he or she doesn't realize is Joe's already got that. He's looking for something else. And then I would say the second thing is just like the salesmanship or saleswomanship that goes on from a VC to the entrepreneur where they feel like, oh, this investor is really interested and they're really committed and they have a lot of conviction. Well, if they had a lot of conviction, they would invest more and more in your company. And what they're doing is they're investing in 20 to 30 companies because portfolio theory shows in venture that like only a few, if any, return, have a chance of returning any of the fund. And so just understanding when I talk and interface with investors, I don't need to expect the world from them. You know, I need fuel for the company and I need someone to not do harm, but they're also going to be making other investments. And so I need to filter out what they're saying.
Diving into kind of the first part of that, obviously when you're looking at like, yeah, I'm an entrepreneur, I look at like a list of like 200 investors, I'm like, okay, these people understand my sector and I email them first kind of thing. And now you're saying actually like those people already have exposure to the sector. And then there's a bunch of other investors, if you email, they'll be like, hey, I don't care about like social network, I'm not going to talk to you kind of thing. So that seems like a hard balance. So you have to find this kind of middle ground people who care enough.
Yeah, I think for entrepreneurs, I mean, certainly reach out and go pull on those threads, but like just understand a layer deeper.
Yeah.
You know, that like people may already have things going and you may be also giving them competitive information, right? So I think of it as like this is gonna be maybe not politically correct, but I think the best way for an entrepreneur to get in front of the right investors is to have a group of core investors that are so excited about the company that they talk about it with other people.
Yeah.
And you get into the rumor mill and the chatter mill of this stuff, and then people will find you. And it is for the Bay Area, obviously. I think it's a little bit trickier when you're not in the Bay Area.
Let's dive into kind of obviously like a more kind of timely topic. You did an interesting blog post recently about kind of public markets. Like a month or a bit ago, everyone seemed like super pessimistic, like the markets were down, etc. Like there's a sudden like kind of optimism, the economy's opening up, etc. In that blog post, though, you were like, your feeling was that actually the kind of private investment sector, VC sector, is still fairly negative. Is that what you're seeing? And like, why do you think it's not like matching the public market optimism?
Yeah. Two points. And yeah, thanks for reading. I think number one is this is all driven by liquidity. So when you can move in and out of a stock or capture a gain in an hour, you feel more comfortable moving cash around. When I'm giving the next Ahmad, $10 million as a private investor, I mean, that's it. It's a one-way wire. And so I think the issues that come up are just a commitment phobia that people have right now because of the uncertainty that's happening. And then also the sort of like pricing, the lock-in of pricing where, you know, it could actually be bad for the entrepreneur to raise at a mispriced round now, because then if they're going along and the investors have to reprice it, it like reduces morale. So basically those are the things going on in the private market. I also feel like the data is pretty clear that like economically, I don't think this is controversial, we're not going up from here. We're going down from here. And that could take a year for reality to sink in for different people. And the stock market of today is very different, where it's algorithmically driven and people can make gains on stuff right away. But I look at more like fundamental signals where you basically have, you know, and I cited this in the piece, you have Warren Buffett basically saying, you know, in the plainest English possible, I just sold all my airline positions. And the guy's not an idiot, you know. He and his team have probably done a lot of work and reading. And then PNC Bank, I think out of Philadelphia, I didn't realize they were an initial early investor in BlackRock. BlackRock is about an $80 to $100 billion publicly traded, you know, private equity firm. They announced yesterday that they're going to sell their entire 22% stake in BlackRock. And I'm going through all this to basically say, if you're someone who's managing illiquid pools of capital like venture capital, there's really no incentive to invest unless you're forced to right now, because the likelihood that the pricing will go down is extremely high. I'm trying to be as like clean as possible with this particular advice, but I really truly believe it. I've met entrepreneurs today who are like, I don't want to raise down, the environment's bad, I'll just wait. It is going to get worse. Mm-hmm. It is going to get worse. And so someone who is pushing off something today for Q3, Q4, it is a very calculated risk. And so if someone has a bird in the hand, I would strongly encourage them to consider it.
Aren't like kind of private equity investors, well, as a VC, supposed to like be betting like 10 years out? Like, why does like a 1 year economic downturn like affect their decisions? Is it just because like valuations should fall because of public market comparables?
The venture capitalist, if you look at it in its most like craven form, is basically an agent for the money source to negotiate pricing with people who can create value. So the job of the VC is to basically say, you know, Kassar, well, we all know Kassar is amazing. He's going to create entrepreneurial value. There's no question. So you as a money source, whether you're CalPERS or the University of Virginia or you name your pool of capital, you want your capital with him. And so you hire these agents who are going to negotiate the price. I think the issue here is that the pricing in order to drive the multiples is really different. Like, for example, one of the best investments I've ever been a part of was a $575,000 round at a $3.75 million post-money round. That deal, this was in 2013, that deal, if it was done in the last couple of years, would have been 3 on 12 right out of the gate. And so not only is the multiple compressed, the entry price really gates the ability to like earn from that. And so if you're an investor, the entry price is super, super important. You know, doing 3 on 12 is not the same as doing 1.5 on 6.
Oh, what was that investment?
It's called HashiCorp.
It's a great investment. I guess like there's this kind of counter narrative, which is that, oh, if it's going to be a $1 billion company, it doesn't matter if you enter at like 5 or 6 or 12 or 13.
Yeah.
Like how do those two things kind of compare to each other?
Well, two things. One is that narrative is largely born out of I think interviews that Peter Fenton has given, and Peter Fenton will go down as one of the top 3 VCs of all time ever. And I don't even think he's 45 yet. So there's a lot to learn. I think a lot of that depends on the Series A when you have some data and signal and you can start to dream with the entrepreneur of how big something can be. If you look at it today, you know, what's the chatter around something like Clubhouse? There's an actual case to be made that like Clubhouse, if things work, I mean, who knows, could be a $1 billion business. Like you have to dream with the entrepreneur. And if you see that upside as a Series A investor and you see early signals, you make that bet and you basically say, look, if I'm writing this at $100 million post money, I have to bet this can be a $5 to $10 billion company, right? And you're trying to build a case in your mind or a narrative of how the product can go into these markets and adjacent markets. I think at the seed level or this early stage, or I go back to the HashiCorp round, you don't have anything. And so you're basically needing to make sure you have the right exposure to these companies. Should that one of them work out, they pay for the rest. This is something I always mention to entrepreneurs, even when they're meeting us and they're like, well, tell us about your business. And I always tell them like how I raise the funds and how we manage a business before we go into business with them. Cause I feel like it's super important they understand what we're doing. Right. And so the way I describe it is, you know, hey, there are going to be 25 to 35 companies in Haystack 5. And we would like to work with you. What we've learned and what other people have shown in their portfolios is actually like, it's very hard to return the value to the fund. It's basically a mix of luck and skill, and you don't get to decide which one. And ultimately, if the fund is lucky, one company will return multiples of the fund. And then a couple of those companies, again, if you're luckier, will basically subsidize the work of the other people. And it's not that the other people didn't do a good job or they weren't worthy of the capital. It's just how things fall out. And so I think when I explain it that way to entrepreneurs, they're like, whoa, like, you know, because you go into that meeting or you go into that relationship thinking like, yeah, like, you know, at worst, I'll sell this for $250 million. And most entrepreneurs don't realize that like even M&A is so like as a percentage of an outcome is so small. So I always try to explain that thing, which is we're all going in this together. Here are the other 35 people. We don't know which one yet. But one of them is likely to basically subsidize your work.
So, I mean, just to put it another way, you think like post product market fit, you make that like, you know, you see the $1 billion bet and that's where like the valuation maybe doesn't matter. And pre product market fit where it's like seed stage, and you really don't know who's going to be a winner or not, then like valuation sensitivity matters.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, like the classic case here is Snap, right? Where there were like 4 or 5 great funds all fighting to do Snap in 2014. You could build a case very quickly, you know, people sharing photos at a rate like this that are never hitting the internet. I mean, that's pretty exciting. And so do you do it at 60 posts, 70 posts, 80 posts? I think if you knew Instagram, you know, Facebook, you just do it. You know what I'm saying? And that's a different, That's a Series A level skill required to do it. If you think of like DoorDash Series A was like 15 on 75 posts, you think about it and you start building the case and say, okay, we're going to be in all these major cities, sub cities. This is the size of the market. And you say 75 posts. I don't care if it's 60 posts, 75 posts, right? I want to be in business with this person. And I think we can go 1 billion, 10 billion.
Is valuation a lever that entrepreneurs can pull? Like, you know, like just, hey, I'm just going to drop my valuation, make this like a very attractive deal, or does that like cheapen the deal in some way?
It's a really good question. So I think entrepreneurs who I've seen be successful in difficult times or difficult rounds will basically say, we don't have pricing expectations. Here's our funding history. And they're transparent with that. And, you know, we understand the venture business model, which is code for basically saying, we know that you have to make money too, or feel like you can make money too in the transaction. And we don't have any preconceived notions about what this should be priced as. We're going to let the market decide that. I think the other approach is to basically set parameters that are fair. And so I think in any, you know, let's say things have shifted a little bit pre-pandemic, in an early stage round or seed round, maybe you take on 15 to 25% dilution. Maybe now you take 20 to 30% dilution, and you basically set a parameter with the investor. And it's a good way to test for reasonableness, where you basically say, hey, look, in a seed round, I'm just not really comfortable with taking more than 25% dilution. There are a couple of reasons. One, it makes me uncomfortable and I want to feel excited about the deal. And two, you know, I have to think about the long-term viability of this cap table, right? So if I raise three rounds of financing to get 10 to 15 million bucks and each one is 20 to 25, it's too much of a hit. And so I think people who take one of those two techniques or combine them together end up being more successful. I think the valuation piece is just, I mean, it's really a mental trap. And, you know, for us, it forces the discipline to invest in creators who, you know, like the whole Paul Graham mantra of just, you know, people should be surprised how few people are in your office. Like, the last checks we've cut have been teams of 2, 3, 4, and they don't really need to hire anyone to go build what they need to build.
Yeah.
They've already had products in market. They've raised $2 million or less in the round. Those fit for us, you know, really nicely. And I think the only other thing I would say is that I think we're going to enter a period of 10 years of like the shots on goal that we all have, whether it's me investing out of a fund, you starting Mercury, the next Imod starting, you know, the next big thing. We kind of exited a period where people have unlimited shots on goal. And I think in the future, the shots on goal are going to be given to people who have proven they can build and ship a product and service before. And so there's going to be some test of like technique and ability to get this. And there are going to be a lot of entrepreneurs who are kind of one and done. You know, they'll start something, they'll kind of flame out, they'll move back to wherever they came from. And that cycle is going to be a faster cycle.
What's a company or product that you invested in or not that you're kind of really excited about recently?
Well, you know, I was an investor in Paul's previous company with Highlight, which is the original contact tracing app. And I think Clubhouse is just a fascinating zeitgeist moment. And I think there are a lot of different ways it can go. It's unclear whether Paul and Rohan will get it there, but they're just super great people and I'm super excited for them.
Has he let you invest yet?
It's an interesting story. We were talking a lot in January and February because he had Talk Show and I was a big fan of Talk Show. He's actually probably going to kill the app. And we talked about it for a long time, but I wanted to tell him that I believe more in curation and more of like a few one to many or few to many. And I think Clubhouse is going in the many to many direction where I have a fundamental disconnect with that. And so I actually didn't invest, but I mean, it's probably going to be a big mistake of mine, given that I've known Paul for years and I invested in his previous company. But I also feel like I have to stay true to what I believe. But I think, you know, there are definitely ways in which this product, you know, what I don't think people have really thought about is, yeah, you're in rooms and it's becoming ambient noise, but you can really go into like Steph Curry and Draymond after a game opening a Clubhouse room. You could have secret rooms, right, where you have digital passwords or knocks. You could have making the default be live only so that there's no record of it and you can control who hears something. You could turn it into a social group app or where you and I may do a phone call for work over Clubhouse with other people. And so I think there's a way it turns into Zoom, Light, House Party, all these things. And the unknown of that is a real challenge, but also I think super exciting. So
yeah, kind of reminds me of Secret. I don't know if you remember Secret right before it was like still sure. Kind of small community. It was like very interesting.
Yeah.
But then when they opened up, it just like became like way too many trolls, too much like...
Yeah, I mean, think of Quora, right? Like Quora was one of the best beta of a product ever. I mean, it was incredible, the knowledge transfer happening in there. And then what happened is they went into verticals and that was fine because you could go film, bio, whatever. And then to grow, I think they went into English-speaking countries and growth in India, growth in Australia, England. And then it became really hard. The social aspect went away and the information aspect came out. So it's a really hard challenge, but I think it's, you know, it's a company that's like the talk of the town now. And it's, you know, maybe I'll be kicking myself even more. I mean, I'm sort of kicking myself now, but.
All right. So if someone wants to follow you or get you as an investor, where can they find you?
To follow is just at Semil, S-E-M-I-L on Twitter. To pitch, I always say, have someone I know recommend you. As sort of un-PC as that sounds, I mean, that's what I pay attention to.
Okay. Well, that's perfect.
All right, man. Okay, cool.